Happiness can be a bit like a moving target. The more you run towards it, the farther away it gets. Well, recently there's been a huge upsurge in interest in actually demystifying happiness. We want to know what makes us happy and why. Well, our guest today has some ideas for us based on polls and other research, and some of it may surprise you. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Arthur C. Brooks teaches public administration at Syracuse University. He's the author of the new book, Gross National Happiness. Brooks is currently a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He looked at a variety of data to find out why happiness matters for America and how we can get more of it. You're invited to join us today as well and tell us if you've hit on a winning formula for happiness and whether you think our leaders should care if Americans are happy. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Arthur Brooks, I'm really glad you could be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, your book was a really fascinating read. It really challenged some of my notions personally about what made people happy. Why is this new area of happiness research like yours so interesting to people right now?
Well, and to begin with, it challenged a lot of what I thought about happiness, too, I have to say. You know, looking at data is a really tough thing to do on something like happiness that people care about. You know, and the question you asked is, you know, why do people care about it? And the reason is because, you know, happiness is what really gets us up in the morning. I'm an economist, which means that I do work on things like, you know, tax policy and various government regulations. And I always generally measured outcomes in people's lives with respect to money. So, for example, I would ask people, what do you think about the inheritance tax? And they would never talk about what it would do to their bottom line. Most Americans really hate it, and it has nothing to do with how it's going to touch them financially. It won't touch most Americans financially. They talk about how it affects their happiness, how fair they think it is, how free it makes them feel. And I said to myself, you know, I need to actually write a book about this thing, happiness, with respect to economics and culture and how policies in this country and how our culture in point of fact is affecting this, if we can measure it. That was something that was, I thought, more fundamental than the ways that we typically do measure human flourishing. Money just doesn't do the trick.
Well, why don't we talk about the areas that you did look at? How did you decide on what points to look at in terms of happiness?
Well, the first thing that I looked at was whether or not you can measure it and how you should measure it in a way that's pretty objective and believable. And then I went on to the big things that people talk about. What are the worldviews that are correlated with the happiest people, and what do we typically assume when we ask people, how could you be happier? They'll tell you certain things, and are those things correct? And if they are or they aren't, as the case may be, should we be doing things differently in our families, in our communities, in our culture, or even from our government to make it such that people can pursue happiness more effectively? After all, the pursuit of happiness is enshrined in our Declaration of Independence. It was kind of a utopian notion at the time, but Thomas Jefferson and the Founding Fathers believed that America was a different kind of country because it was a place in which not just nobility, you know, wealthy people had the right to define their happiness and chase after it, but that everybody did. And if we believe that's true, then I think that we have a responsibility to try to take the idea of the pursuit of happiness rather seriously.
Well, one of the things that surprised me was that, taken as a whole, when you looked at what increased happiness most of the time, was that it seemed like something that William F. Buckley would have been really pleased to put his stamp on. It was really traditional stuff. It was down to the fact that conservatives were more happy than liberals. It was family. It was marriage. It was working more, not less. Why did that surprise you?
Some of it did. And to put a different kind of point on it, I think I write in the book, I try to write in the book that, you know, we think big enough about the ideas of traditional values such that it might not always make traditional conservatives like William F. Buckley completely happy, some of the conclusions that we have. So it is true that you find that political conservatives tend to be much happier than political liberals, and about half of the happiness gap. Incidentally, they tend to be about twice as likely to say that they're very happy people as liberals, and half of that gap is explained by things like religion and marriage. The other half is explained primarily by the belief, correct or incorrect, that hard work and perseverance can get one ahead. In other words, they still have a kind of sunny optimism is what you find characteristically. But that said, when we talk about things like religion and marriage, there's no evidence that suggests that only traditional religion, only conservative religion, only the religion of your grandparents is the kind that works. On the contrary, you find that people who take their spiritual lives, their interior lives very seriously, under traditional and non-traditional circumstances, tend to be equally happy. Furthermore, you find that what really brings people happy in the way that we measure it with respect to marriage is really loving relationships. And so there's nothing in the data that say that, you know, traditional marriage between one man and one woman is the unique happiness blend. That's a cultural question. You know, reasonable people disagree about what marriages should look like legally. What you find in the data is that when people pair into loving relationships, homosexual, heterosexual, whatever, that's what brings all the happiness. So it's kind of traditional values, not very traditionally understood, that bring happiness.
Well, and it's interesting, the point on religion, that's one that seems to really bring happiness to people. And yet when you cross compare to other countries, some of the other countries who show up on the happiest list, Denmark, Norway, that they're pretty secular countries. Is there something unique about America and the way that we use religion to bring happiness, do you think?
I think there is, actually. You know, I've, as you can imagine, I've given that a lot of thought. I don't talk very much in this particular book about cross-country comparisons, and part of the reason is because there's so much disagreement in the data. You can find some surveys that say that Denmark and Norway and Sweden are by far the happiest countries. You can find other surveys that say the United States is a lot happier than those countries, and they're all internationally gathered data, and so it makes you think, well, I think we don't really know, depending on what study we look at. On the other hand, when we look within the United States, you find that every survey shows that people who take their religious life seriously are much happier. There's a lot of consensus, and I focus in this book on where the consensus is. But let's assume, which I think is reasonable, that Denmark and Sweden and Norway, for example, are pretty happy countries, and they are extraordinarily secular countries. It's a really small minority of people attend church. Now, we don't know if in Denmark people are truly secular. We don't have surveys that say, okay, do you actually not take your spiritual life seriously? My guess is you'd find that a lot of people are less traditionally religious than they are in the United States, but that doesn't make them unspiritual. But to a bigger point, the structure of religion is different in America than it is in these other countries. It's played a different role in American society. In most European countries, there's been sort of a monopoly religion for the longest time. And the United States is characterized by a pretty, I hate to sound like an economist, but I will, a competitive market for souls, for lack of a better way of putting it. We have this non-establishment clause in our Constitution saying that the government is not going to be a monopolist with respect to religion, is not going to say anything about which is the right religion, or furthermore, to even give it any money. If we believe that's true, which I believe it is, one of the great benefits of, you know, that sort of philosophy is the fact that it keeps the state out of this business, which ultimately proves to be very fruitful in helping individuals make their own decisions and actually makes people more religious. I think that religion is really a rather different phenomenon in America than it is in Europe.
So obviously you're not advocating for governments to get involved and sort of mandate any sort of religious observance, but do you think that to encourage happiness, the government should be somehow encouraging spiritual practice for happiness?
I think that the government should be exceptionally tolerant of religious expression. I mean, I think that, once again, the separation of church and state has been a wonderful blessing for religion in this country and for religious people. I think it's made people more religious, and it's made religion stronger because of this lack of you know, government mandate and government subsidy. At the same time, the question is, okay, if we do have this separation, I mean, the big argument that we have in the United States is, what does that mean? Does that mean any religious expression that's arguably connected to the public sphere, is that impermissible? And my view is that we should actually be more as tolerant as we can be about the expression of people's faiths, not one particular faith, because that would be unconstitutional, but of faith in general, simply because spiritual life is so critically important.
So you're saying you could be talking about yoga here, you could be talking about Catholicism, anything constitutes religion.
Yeah, anything that actually, in my view, well, according to the data, anything that helps people to expand their sense of meaning in a spiritual realm. This works. I mean, I'm not going to say which religion. I mean, I have my own religious views, but that's beside the point, because the data simply don't allow me to say that my particular religious views are somehow best in America. They when it comes to happiness, they just aren't.
Well, let's move on to a different area of happiness research that you looked at. What about marriage and kids? It seems like marriage makes people really, really happy, and then kids makes happiness take a dive. That really surprised me.
Yeah, it really surprised me, too. Shared that with my wife. She said, "Now you tell me after we have three kids." You know, and it's what you find is that marriage has a very unique place in the happiness of people. It's almost as if we're wired for monogamous, loving relationships. That's what the data appear to suggest. Now, there are a lot of people who sort of disagree with that, but it just seems so clear that once people couple, and particularly if they have relationships that are relatively stable, they just do better. They do better in life satisfaction and optimism and all different measures of success in their lives, and life is more satisfying. Now, the question is, what happens when kids come along? Which for most couples is sort of inevitable. Most traditional married couples, that's inevitable. And you'd expect in something like this, because, you know, reading along, you say, okay, marriage is good. That's good, a good, wholesome, traditional value. Having kids will be even better. And it's not true. At least not true according to the data. One of the greatest ways that happiness is delivered to us, the transmission mechanism, if you will, is the quality of our marriages. Since coupling is such a big deal, loving relationships are so critically important, the quality of the relationship itself bears on our life satisfaction an awful lot. And you find that the quality of a marriage, not inevitably, but in the overwhelming majority of cases, significantly falls on the birth of the first child, particularly for the woman. It's a very interesting thing. And you know why this is. You know, the autonomy and control, not to mention the sleep that you give up when your first child comes along, is that people find their relationships less satisfying. And it continues to fall until the first child is about six. Then it comes up a little bit, and then it just goes down to its absolute lowest point when you have an adolescent. Now, the payoff,
however, is
at the end. If your marriage survives until your kids are 16, 17, and especially when they start to move out, on average, the quality of marriage and consequently the life satisfaction tends to improve all the way till death. So all I can say is hang on.
So you're saying that if we make it till our kids are 16, then is it that then they leave the nest and then we can focus on our marriages? Or are you saying that then once they're 16 and leave the nest, then their very presence enhances the married couple's life?
Well, what the study suggests is that couples start to gain more control over their own lives, but that they do have these people with whom they're very, very connected and with whom they have these loving familial relationships that are quite important as well. So it's basically both of those things that lead to life satisfaction that's increasing all the way till the end. Now, it's one of these things, you know, when I talk about this, I don't want to overemphasize the idea that kids are horrible for happiness, because there are a lot of reasons that that's not true. The first is that kids bring something that's arguably more important than happiness, which is meaning. Children give people a sense of meaning, which actually does lead to happiness indirectly and a lot of happiness indirectly. Meaning is one of the characteristics of truly happy people. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is that not having kids isn't a very good loophole, because it's really the happiest people going in that have the kids. It's what you find. And furthermore, kids are kind of part of a happiness bundle for most people's lives. If you compare people who take care of their spiritual lives, who are married, who are in, you know, stable families, and who have kids, you'll find that they're three or four times happier than people who do not have all those life characteristics and also don't have kids. In other words, kids might bring you down by a few percentage points, but all the other stuff that comes along with kids brings people way, way, way up. So not having kids is not sort of a way around, you know, trying to get happier generally.
Hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting because you talk about a study that looked at senior citizens, and sometimes people think, well, I'm going to have children, so they'll bring me happiness in my twilight years. And studies have found that seniors without children are just as happy as seniors with children.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And, you know, there's this something that psychologists call the tyranny of the counterfactual, which is kind of a basic idea. We have to put fancy words on basic ideas. That's how in university we get promotion and tenure, basically. But the whole idea is that we imagine things that could have been, and we act because we don't want those other lives that we didn't have. People buy lottery tickets because they imagine, if I didn't buy a lottery ticket, the number I would have bought might have come up. Well, it's very complex thinking, but it's also crazy when you think about it. A common error that a lot of women make is that they marry men they don't love because they imagine not getting married and then not having kids and then dying alone and lonely. That's the tyranny of the counterfactual that leads a lot of women to make big mistakes in their personal lives. But in fact, when you look at the data, you find that there is no real tyranny of the counterfactual. If you marry somebody you don't love, you're basically guaranteeing yourself misery. And women who, particularly women more than men, who don't have kids but have satisfying adult lives, they sacrifice virtually nothing at all.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a break right now and come back and talk more with our guest this hour, Arthur Brooks. He's the author of the book Gross National Happiness, Why Happiness Matters for America and How We Can Get More of It. Hoping you'll be joining us this hour as well and telling us what makes you happy, whether you've hit on a winning formula for happiness, and whether you think that the government should get more involved in making Americans happy. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11 o'clock today on Wisconsin Public Radio, stay tuned for Larry Mueller and Garden Talk. After 11 o'clock, Larry's first guest is a turfgrass expert. He is John Steyer, Associate Professor of Horticulture at the UW-Madison. And then at 12 noon, the focus shifts to native sedges with the author of Field Guide to Wisconsin Sedges. I'm Veronica Rickert, keeping you company this hour here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today we're considering happiness with the author of Gross National Happiness, Arthur C. Brooks. And Arthur Brooks, we're going to go to the phone lines now and pick up a call from Ralph in Madison. Hello, Ralph. You're on the air.
Hi. I have had the HIV and advanced HIV disease since I was in my 20s. I'm going on 24 years now, starting number 25. And a long time ago, I found that happiness was my key to survival, laughter being one of the greater things that I needed to do more of. I had to dig deep and find that happiness within myself. Externally, I had religious groups and people telling me it was my fault, it was my my curse from God for being a gay man. And I had to overcome all of those religious boundaries or barriers, I guess, and find my inner happiness. And I have done that. And in the process in the last 25 years, I've discovered, lately, some of my drugs have increased depression. It's one of the side effects. So I'm taking, you know, antidepressants first time. But I truly find my happiness in myself. And Buddhism has become something that has helped me a great deal just because it puts so little significance on the person. And that seems to make me happy. My minute status in the universe.
So sort of the shrinking of the self has helped you expand your own happiness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you sound happy. Have there been other things besides the Buddhism that you've incorporated?
I have not had a stable relationship. I had one until I got the HIV. I'd started the Madison AIDS Support Network. I was its founder. And that gave me happiness for a while, but it was helping others constantly. And then I had to go inside myself and say, wait a minute, that's not really helping me. And I was working with a therapist who became the co-founder with me and truly dug into it and found that I needed to find my happiness within myself. I wasn't going to get it anywhere else but from myself. There were too many things telling me, too many people telling me that I should not be happy, that it was my fault. It was the curse of being a gay man. And organized religion became something that I abhor.
So were you saying that when you were doing things for others, that increased or decreased your happiness?
It made me happy to be doing things for others. And I thought I was, you know, truly happy about it. But what I was doing was avoiding my sadness by throwing myself into incredible feats of helping people. And when I got straightened around a little, I really had to dig inside and realize that what I needed to do was laugh a lot and be happy with myself. And I think that was a very key survival technique for me in the early stages of HIV because there was no drug. You know, and I survived and watched my friends die, and it could have been a horrid time for me. But I had to really dig inside and find my inner happiness.
Do you think that your happiness had something to do with the fact that, health-wise, that you've been doing so well?
Absolutely. I have maintained a very high level of good health. There was a period of time where I had a couple of things that popped up, and I was technically given AIDS as a diagnosis because of those early descriptors. But now, the definition of AIDS has changed over 25 years, and I don't have AIDS. I have HIV. I have HIV disease, and it is, you know, a long-term, and I really think that finding my inner happiness and making peace with myself and not listening to the outside world condemning me, and a very strong family support during this all, that I have survived. I'm a survivor.
All right. Well, thank you, Ralph. Thanks for your call, and we wish you well.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Arthur Seabrook's a lot to touch on there. Obviously, Ralph was using Buddhist meditation, and that seems to really have helped him. What about the idea also that people who sort of insist on their own happiness do better?
Well, there's been a lot of research that says that's exactly right. I mean, he's a real. I mean, think 24 years since his HIV diagnosis. That's fantastic, and there's a lot of research that does say that when people are happier, when people have more life satisfaction, when they pay attention to the things that actually will give them joy in their lives, that they are healthier. I mean, there are sort of contradictory evidence on that, but I think it makes, here's really, whether or not it gives you an extra 10 or 20 or 30 years of life is almost beside the point. And that was brought home to me by the experience of a friend of mine recently who went to the doctor, and the doctor gave him a very strange piece of information, which is that he was my age, he was in his early 40s, and the doctor said, you have 15 years left to live, which is a weird diagnosis because it was because of a congenital heart issue. It's if you get 1 month to live, that's one thing. If they say you'll live to the end of your natural life, that's another. But how do you deal with it when you have 15 years? You don't mope around. You have to get a life strategy, and he did. He did probably what any of us would do. He says, okay, I have a third as much of my life as I thought I was going to have. In that 15 years, I'm going to be a better father. I'm going to be a better citizen. I'm going to be a better giver, church member. I'm going to squeeze as much happiness into that 15 years as I could have gotten in the next 40 if I had lived to be an old man. And he actually undertook certain strategies that I think that we all kind of understand about giving, about non-materialism, about cultivating our friendships and our families and taking our religious lives seriously. And, you know, he is happier than virtually anybody I know. He's doing what it takes to get the serious business of happiness. And if you do that, okay, who's going to say if he dies at 60 instead of dying at 90, that he somehow got shortchanged. On the contrary, he's stuffing more into his shorter life than most of us probably will in our longer lives.
Maybe a lesson to get serious about being happy.
Indeed. You know, this is really the serious business that we have. I mean, it's in our Declaration of Independence. But, you know, even more to the point, here's a reason that we should be caring that other people, this is not just personal, other people should care about their happiness. There's a lot of evidence that shows that happy people are better citizens. They're better parents. They commit fewer crimes. They give more money and time to charity. They engage in all sorts of antisocial behaviors far, far less. In other words, it's great for me that I'm happy, but it's great for me that you're happy, it turns out. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, thinking about this and helping each other is so critically important to a strong culture and a strong country.
Okay, let's go back to the phones and take a call from Steve in Stevens Point. Hi, Steve.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've found that the thing that makes me the happiest in my life so far, anyway, is volunteering my time. I serve on the board for Habitat for Humanity in Stevens Point. And I've found a great deal of satisfaction comes from just helping people improve their lives and being a part of that. Is there any of that in the research that you have uncovered that shows that volunteering time and being out there, putting yourself out there like that is a factor on happiness?
I think there is, Arthur C. Brooks.
There sure is. I talk a lot in this book about whether or not money can buy happiness, and you know, I'm sure we'll talk about that later. The bottom line is it doesn't, for all sorts of interesting reasons. But there's one loophole. I can actually offer you $100, or perhaps in your case, 100 hours of happiness right now. But you have to give your time and money away. There's cutting edge brain research out there right now that shows when people give their money and volunteer their time, give their blood, engage in even informal acts of charity, that it boosts their endorphin levels. It gives them something called the helper's high. It lowers their stress hormones, the hormones that make you feel miserable. It will actually physically lower those hormones. It will do certain things that will actually help you to live longer and be happier day to day. And that's a physical phenomenon. That's not just some sort of emotional advice. And what that tells us is that, you know, this is one of the keys to success. You find that the people who are the happiest and who have the best outcomes, emotional outcomes in their lives, traditionally are those who are really focused on creating value for other people. They feel successful in creating value for others. They're oriented towards service. And, you know, you've figured that out. Congratulations.
And this isn't just the giving away of money, but this is actually volunteering your time as well.
Sure. It's basically, the research shows that when we give away things that we personally value, we just do better than when we don't. And, you know, there are a couple of reasons for that. One of the reasons is that a characteristic of happy people is that they feel like they are in control in their lives. They feel like they have a control over their environment. The best way to give yourself control is to be a problem solver. It's also the best way to no longer feel like a victim. You actually cognitively can't parallel process the ideas that you're a victim and that you're a problem solver. You may be a victim. There are a lot of things wrong, and there's a lot of mistreatment in our world. But focusing on a culture of victimhood, generally speaking, brings a whole lot of misery. And reorienting oneself toward being a problem solver, regardless of one's circumstances, brings clinically proven short path to happiness. So, and this is one of the reasons that helping others simply gives us more control and consequently more happiness.
Did you get happier as you were researching happiness? I find that just talking about it sort of makes me feel happier.
It sure does. You know, knowledge is power when it comes to happiness. We say, okay, either you're happy or you aren't, but there's so much at our disposal for making correct decisions. You know, I get to talk to you on the radio and to your listeners right now about the whole concept of happiness, about making right decisions. That in and of itself is highly empowering. You know, for the longest time I had this belief, this sort of nagging sensation that happiness is kind of beyond my control. And there's actually this fascinating research out there that tells us that some part of our happiness kind of is beyond our control. There's these studies of identical twins who are adopted to different families at birth, which is a wonderful experiment for figuring out what part of their personalities is nature and what part of their personalities is nurture, because they're genetic carbon copies of each other. but they grew up in different environments. And what these studies show is that somewhere around 50% of our cheerfulness, of our baseline happiness, is actually transmitted genetically, which is just crazy when you think about it.
It's a big number.
Means that if you actually thought that your mother made you unhappy, well, you know, you're right. Basically, it's just not the way you thought, it turns out. But that means that half of our happiness is under our control. That raises the stakes for getting the decisions right, and the knowledge on this is power. If we focus on meaning in our lives, on trying to create and being successful at creating value in our lives, and having control over our environments, those are the three things. If we start our days saying, what am I going to do to get meaning, success, and control? What am I going to try to do in my culture so that my government empowers people to have meaning, success, and control? We're going to get more happiness. And that right there, it sets us on the right trail.
Let's take another call now. We've got Bill on the line from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
I have heard an analysis of these happiness studies. It says that people who identify themselves as politically or religiously moderate, that these people tend to be a little more unhappy because they're not very certain of their opinions. They're not sure. They're just never really sure, I guess, if they're right. I guess while people who tend to be strongly, you know, identify themselves strongly liberal or strongly conservative or strongly religious, they're very certain of what they believe. And I don't know, I was wondering if maybe you could touch on that. That's all. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bill. Arthur Brooks?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is a very interesting finding when we talk about the politics of happiness, that people who have extreme views on either the left or the right are happier than moderates in general. Now, I did not want to find this in the data.
It's a little troubling. Yeah.
I wanted to find, because I'm somebody who has very moderate political views, I wanted to find that I'm the happiest because I'm more reasonable than other people. And, you know, these crazy bumper stickers and yard signs, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. That's an advertisement of misery, right? Well, the answer is no, not right. And the reason for it appears to be that people who have very, very extreme political views, it's kind of like secular religion. They have a real sureness. It's exactly what the caller brought up just now. They know the way things are, and it's not just that their opponents are wrong, their opponents are evil. It's a kind of fundamentalism that we find out there. And that sureness actually brings a lot of cheerfulness. So the idea that, you know, we're miserable as we march, that's actually quite wrong. People who denounce the other side and call them evil, generally speaking, are doing it with a pretty light heart. The problem is they bring the rest of us down.
Well, that's really interesting in terms of its implications for who we choose as a political leader, because, you know, you sort of want someone who looks carefully at something, who agonizes over it, maybe even to get to the right point, rather than someone who has maybe a more entrenched point of view. You want someone who can admit if they're wrong. On the other hand, you know, does this mean that we should be voting for the most miserable candidate instead of the happiest candidate?
I hope not, but I agree with you. We want people who are nuanced, people who can actually understand the point of view of others. I mean, one of the characteristics of people who are intelligent, if not happy, is the ability to see the opposing point of view. And if we can't all actually look at the United States and say, my goodness, what a great country this is, where I can disagree with you and nobody's going to knock on my door and take me to jail. It's an extraordinary place. It's unprecedented politically, at least if we look back a few hundred years. Yet this idea that we somehow need to vilify the enemy is very, very troubling. I do want leaders that are more moderate. Now, I guarantee you, looking at the data, you can be a moderate and still be happy. It's just that people who are very extreme tend to get the extra boost of religion from their politics.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break now and then come back and talk more with Arthur C. Brooks. He teaches public administration at Syracuse University, and he is the author of the book Gross National Happiness. We hope you'll be joining in our conversation as well this hour and telling us what makes you happy, maybe what you're looking for in a political leader in terms of how they might make you happy as well. The number to call is 1-800-642-1061. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. We'd be happy to hear what makes you happy and your questions for Arthur Brooks on how to be happier. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio. At 12:30, you can listen to Chapter a Day with Jim Fleming. Today, we'll be concluding the reading from Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain by neurologist Oliver Sacks. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we consider happiness and what makes Americans happy. We're looking at new research from Arthur C. Brooks in his book Gross National Happiness, talking about what makes Americans happy and how we can be happier. We're going to take a phone call now from Liz in Madison. Hi, Liz, you're on the air.
Thank you. I wanted to make a comment about spirituality and religion and the distinction from the earlier talking with Arthur. It seemed that those two were collapsed. And spirituality, everyone is spiritual and has their practices. And some people have particular religion that serves their spirituality, and they believe in particular beliefs and practices along with that. But everybody is spiritual, and that's the distinction that I wanted to make.
So, Liz, are you saying that you'd like to see the research divided into people's spirituality and people who practice an organized religion?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just making that distinction that everyone is spiritual, and some people practice a particular religion, and some people don't. And the spirituality, which is the experience of meaning, which we've already alluded to, is the source of happiness as I see it.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call, Liz.
You're welcome.
Arthur Brooks?
Thank you.
Well, it's I think that certainly everybody has a latent spirituality, and I think that's what the caller meant. What we find, though, is that there are a lot of people who don't take their spirituality very seriously. It doesn't play an important part in their lives. And so there are even surveys that ask people, how important is your spirituality to you? And there are certain people, a non-trivial, a quarter of the population says, it's not important at all. These people are less happy. These people have sort of a less, in essence, a less examined life, and it does chart right back into the sense of meaning that we have. We find this, sort of all across the population, but it's particularly true for younger people, and, younger people are kind of finding their way, obviously. Now, one of the easiest ways to practice spirituality, of course, is traditional religion, but that's, as I said before, that's not the only way to do it. So, you don't have to convert somebody into a particular religion to get some of these happiness gains, but helping ourselves and others to examine sort of the interior life, whatever that means, is really a way to help people to bring out their happiness. And there's one really interesting study that points out some of these points, makes some of these things. And this was one study that looks at senior citizens and says, okay, let's look at the fear of death. The fear of death is highly correlated with life satisfaction and happiness. Ironically, it's not that the happiest people fear death. It's usually the unhappiest people fear death, and which might seem kind of paradoxical. If you love your life on this earth, you might be most afraid of death. That's not true. Now, the question is, with respect to religion or spirituality, it doesn't matter which one you look at, which groups are least afraid of death? And the answer when it comes to religion is this. You find that people who practice a religion very seriously are least afraid of death. That makes sense. But also people who are complete atheists tend to not be afraid of death. The people who are most afraid of dying are people who have a religion but don't practice it. In other words, people who belong to some sort of religious group but they're lukewarm about their spirituality are the ones who are really deeply troubled the most by death.
That's interesting. Well, let's go on and take another phone call. We've got Mary on the line from Madison. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm enjoying the program, although I must say that statement, money doesn't bring happiness, always reminds me of the old saw that it's something the rich people invented to keep the poor people from killing them. You look at anybody that doesn't have health insurance, their kids are in bad schools, and I don't believe that for a second. It's comforting to think that, however. But I called to ask two things. And one is, I was taken aback to hear the other day that according to government statistics, almost half of the children in this country are now born outside of a formal marriage. And indeed, in my job, I have met many, many of their parents who tend to say the same things. We don't need a piece of paper, and having a piece of paper doesn't mean you'll stay together, and we're not ready to be married yet. We've got three kids, but we're not ready to be married yet. I thought he might touch on that. And the other thing I wanted to mention before I get too hoarse to talk here, as the baby boomers get older, the sad fact is that women seem to live a little longer than men. And again, through work, I've met many, many older women who lost their husbands earlier than they might have expected to. And I always hear two things from them, both extremes. One is the sad, rather bitter group that immediately say the men are only interested in chasing after young girls. There's no chance now that anybody would remarry me. And the other group who says, which makes me even more sad, all these old men want is a nursemaid. And I don't think that's true at all. I know some lovely older men who were happy married and they want to be married again. And I always wonder what mixture of dashed hope and afraid to hope is combined in these two stances. And I will be in advance thanking you for your thoughts here.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mary. And Arthur Brooks, I know you have some research about what happens to women who lose a spouse, but I want to touch on Mary's first point about children born outside of wedlock. What about happiness in a committed relationship, a monogamous relationship that doesn't include the institution of marriage?
It's great. It works. It's committed relationships are, it's almost as if looking at the data. You know, I'm not a theologian or I don't know anything about natural law, but I will tell you that looking at the data, it appears that's what we're built for, is stable, loving relationships. Now, about the piece of paper, it's complicated. You find that couples that live together who aren't married, you find that they're, frankly, a lot less stable on average. 90% of cohabiting couples who aren't married break up. 90%. They don't go on the divorce rolls, and that's the reason, for example, that certain groups that rarely live together before they get married, such as evangelical Christians, they appear to have the same divorce rates as everybody else. Actually, they don't, because they don't live together first. And the people who do live together first overwhelmingly are likely to break up before they finally have a marriage that will have the same likelihood of working as everybody else's. And so the whole, we know that happiness follows loving relationships. What's the best pattern for the highest likelihood of success? What's best for culture? That's what, you know, all of us have to think about with respect to our ethics, our morals, and our public policies.
And how about Mary's comments about what happens, you know, with women living longer than men and maybe looking for a second partner and women's happiness then?
Yeah, this is interesting about happiness as it follows marital status, including widowhood. Just as a general rule, women are happier than men. This, as a general, if you got to make one assumption, this is about gender or sex and happiness. That's it. But there's a few complications in it. The first is that you find that single women are happier than single men. Married women are happier than married men. Widowed women, notwithstanding the fact that a lot are really lonely, are much happier in general than married men. You find widowed men. When men are widowed, their likelihood of mortality goes through the roof. You find that they're just much more likely to die, and they're half as likely as widowed women to say that they're very happy people. The only group of women that's less happy are those who are separated or divorced, and that charts. That's even if you correct for, you know, what happens to their income, and that has a lot to do with the fact that women who are divorced typically are in a position of single parenthood, which is hugely stressful and attenuates life happiness, at least in the near term, rather a lot.
What about something Mary mentioned at the very beginning about money buying happiness? And you talk about the economics of happiness, that money doesn't buy it. How can you support that?
Well, economists look at that question in basically three ways. The first way they look at is poor versus rich countries. And you find that, in fact, you know, consistent with what Mary said, money does buy happiness, but only if you are desperately poor at the point of starvation or dying of preventable diseases. You find that countries where people are below the level of subsistence truly are unhappy. But once countries get above the level of subsistence, their happiness equals out, and additional wealth and income that, like we enjoy in the developed world, doesn't bring very much happiness at all. So you find, for example, that Mexico is a much happier country according to most surveys. And once again, that kind of data is kind of dicey. But most surveys say Mexico is a much happier country than France, despite having one-third of the average purchasing power. Okay, and so those things are That's sort of the strike one in the idea that money buys happiness. The second is what happens in a country like the United States as our whole population gets richer. And, you know, since the early 1970s, every income group, despite what politicians and columnists frequently tell us, pretty much every single income group in America has gotten richer, just that the rich have gotten richer way faster than the poor have gotten richer. Now, what is that? How much happiness has that brought us in any single income group? And the answer is none. We find that, you know, income has grown by 50% in real terms across the whole population purchasing power since the early 1970s, and this percentage of the population saying they're very happy has stayed stable. And the last is what happens to individuals when you look at their lives as they earn more and more money. Once again, if they start out at starvation levels or they don't have health care, those types of stresses really do bring unhappiness, as Mary correctly indicated. But if you get above that at all, and it doesn't take that much to get above those basic levels.
I think I read 10,000.
About 15,000. About 15,000 today. There's inflation, you know.
Okay.
And you find that above 15,000, it's you have to bring, you know, hundreds of thousands of extra dollars to get anything even remotely noticeable. It's a terrible investment in your happiness is going to get extra money.
That's so interesting. Do you have any supposition for why that is?
Well, it's one of the things that we find is that what really does bring happiness is a sense that you are a successful person, however you define it, in terms of raising your kids or in terms of your job or your community service or whatever. If you feel you're creating value, if you feel you're a successful person, you will be happy. Typically, money follows success. People who feel like really successful people tend to earn more money. But it's not the same. Money and the success are not the same thing. The real tragedy is that people have a tendency to mistake the measure of success for the underlying thing that really brings happiness, and they follow the wrong thing. Materialism is a measurement problem in our lives. Now, there's one really interesting statistic that's emerging from new studies that asks, what's the most miserable age in a man's life on average? Not women, men. Women do so much better. You want to look at men who are more miserable generally. And the average saddest age in a man's life is age 44, it turns out, which, you know, I looked at that with some interest because last Wednesday I turned 44. Okay. Now, what's the deal on that? And the standard explanation is that's the age when your wife figures out that you're a bore or you've got an adolescent in the home or something like that. But
right.
A more compelling explanation is that's when you figure out that success and money are not the same thing and you've been chasing the wrong variable. That's, you know, sort of the classic midlife crisis.
Interesting. Well, let's go on to the phones again. We've got Mariel calling from Sinsinawa. Welcome, Mariel.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And my time is limited, so I'll try to get my point across and then just have to go. I think you can have a basic, deep-down joy within yourself and in relationship with other people, too, without being so-called happy. Now, I don't equate the word happy with joy necessarily. For instance, I feel very happy in myself, but I'm very concerned about the condition of our world and the war and all the other things that are happening. But still, I feel very joyful. And so I wondered if he would talk about whether he equates joy and happiness. Mm. Because you can be happy about superficial things.
Right. All right. Well, but, thank you for your call, Mariel.
Okay. Thank
Brooks?
You. I have to hang up and go now.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Arthur Brooks?
Yeah, there's a wonderful set of studies that ask whether happiness and unhappiness, we can experience them simultaneously. And the answer is clearly yes. And the reason for that is that we process happy and unhappy feelings in different parts of our brains. The place in our brain where we have happy feelings, you know, feelings where you have joy day to day, or where you feel like your life is especially satisfying, those moments where you really do feel classically happy, occur in the left front of our brains. Whereas on the right side, that's where we experience unhappy feelings, how you feel when somebody insults you or cuts you off in traffic or who, you know, we taste something that's really objectionable. And what that means is that, you know, while we can't parallel process happiness and unhappiness simultaneously, we can't have both of those feelings at the same time for rather complicated reasons. We do know that we can have a lot of happy feelings and a lot of unhappy feelings. And so you'll find some people that are deeply aware and rather unhappy about circumstances in the world, but who also have a pretty elevated mood a lot of the time. You can be at the top of your happiness group and the top of your unhappiness group at the same as one person.
And we have time for one more phone call, just about a minute left to go. So, Carol, if you could keep your comments short.
I'm wondering if you've thought about the works of Viktor Frankl and C.S. Lewis, for example, that you really cannot pursue happiness, that it's a byproduct of pursuing a meaningful life. I think you're implying that.
All right, thanks so much.
I absolutely am. You know, there are three characteristics of happy. If you look around, you find the happiest person you know, you're going to find three characteristics. You're going to find that, A, they have a sense of meaning. And incidentally, Viktor Frankl's most famous book was called Man's Search for Meaning, all about that very concept, people who know why they're alive and maybe even know why they die. Meaning is critical, so that's why, you know, family life and particularly religion are so critical. Success in terms of creating value, we just talked about that. It's the second characteristic of a happy person. And the third characteristic typically is a sense of control. Happy people don't feel like victims. They believe that hard work and perseverance on the important things in their lives will bear fruit. They think that they have some measure of control over their environment. And all of those things together tell us that people who are living on purpose are the ones most likely to have meaning, success, and control. These are the objectives, in my view, that all of us can use to achieve a happier life and that we can give to other people in our culture, even perhaps through our public policies.
Well, Arthur Brooks, it's been a great hour, a happy hour, I'll go so far as to say. So thank you so much for spending your time with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a joy for me, too.
We've been talking with Arthur Brooks. He teaches public administration at Syracuse University, and he's the author of Gross National Happiness. I want to thank Rhonda Fanning and Carmen Jackson for their production this morning, and Sarah Carroll for on-air production. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.